Hey everyone, To Kill a Mockingbird won the Pulitzer and sold 40 million copies, so I'm glad they published Go Set a Watchman to flesh out the Alabama expanded universe.
I'm Kellen Erskine. I'm a comic, a father, and I was pleasantly surprised while reading this book, which at first I thought was part of the Hunger Games.
And I'm David Vance. Just like Harper Lee, I too fantasize about killing those who mock me. I assume that's what the book is about. I did not read it. To Kill a Mockingbird follows the protagonist, Scout, as she earns zero merit badges.
And this is the book pile. All right, listener Arp Ibe says, I love books. I love comedy. Kellen and Dave's winning combination of the two makes me look forward to each new episode. Even with books I wouldn't normally be interested in, I know I'll always get a laugh and a few good insights, such as the benefits of wigging a kid. And if you want to know what that means, listen to our episode with Natalie Madsen when we cover Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban.
Yeah, if it's taken out of context, the phrase wigging a kid sounds so bad.
Yeah, it sounds a lot more abusive than it actually is, which it is a tiny bit. Real quick, if this is your first time listening to the podcast, welcome. This is a comedy podcast. Obviously, this week's book lends itself to slightly more serious territory, but we still keep it fun. And for our absolute funniest episodes, I personally recommend you at least check out the ones we did on The Seven Habits, Sense and Sensibility, a biography of Leonardo da Vinci, my favorite, and of course, our roasts of the Twilight books. Also, right now we have a holiday promo going on until January 10th. Give us a review on Apple or Spotify or both. Take a screenshot, and we'll send you your choice of any of the books we've covered on the podcast. Just send the screenshot and your mailing address to thebookpilepodcast@gmail.com, and we'll even both sign the book to you, the book we didn't write. We've done this promotion before, and there are always some people who wonder if it's real. This is real. You have until January 10th.
Finally, our next two books are So You've Been Publicly Shamed and Something Wicked This Way Comes, which is what I say loudly when I'm approached by someone who's been shamed.
All right, and if you want to see me live, I'm going to be at the Helium Comedy Club in Philadelphia, December 30th through January 1st. Go to KellenErskine.com for tickets and come make your New Year's resolution to see me.
There was a year when my brother Johnny's New Year's resolution was to see I Am Legend, and then we saw it that day.
All right, and without further ado, here are five lessons that we learned from To Kill a Mockingbird.
All right, lesson one. Goodness is a skill that can be learned. Or as we said in our last episode, it can at least be faked. So I think we sometimes treat goodness like it's an attribute like height that you either have or don't have. When really, I think the best people I know just have a lot of practice doing good. Mm. Like they've put in their 10,000 hours of goodness. And there's a great quote by Democritus who said, "More men become good through practice than by nature." And I bring this up with Atticus because I think a big part of learning a skill is first seeing someone else do it. Marion Wright Edelman said, "You can't be what you can't see," which is how I know I'll never be invisible. So I think if you want kids who stand up to racism, I think it's really helpful for them to see characters like Atticus who model that kind of behavior. Mm. I would also add, though, that the model by itself isn't enough. You also need practice. There's a great story in The Power of Moments about James Lawson, this civil rights leader who, before doing a sit-in, he would literally practice with his protesters. He'd have actors come in and shove them, yell at them, put cigarette ash on them, and he was literally having them practice being courageous.
Wow.
So for me, it's encouraging to know whatever good qualities I want to have, I can learn them. All right, lesson two. We are often endeared to people for their flaws. So Scout is such a funny narrator, and so much of it comes from her little quirks and flaws. So at one point, her neighbor Dill proposes to her, but then he forgets and kind of ignores her. So to get his attention back, she repeatedly beats him up.
We've all been engaged, right?
No.
It's a way to hit the brakes on a podcast.
Another time she's hoping that if she starts swearing, Atticus will pull her out of school. So one of my and my sister Jess's favorite lines in literature is when at the dinner table she's like, pass the damn ham, please.
And for anyone who hasn't read this yet, she's like 7 when she says that.
Her Aunt Alexandra's description of her is, I was born good, but had grown progressively worse every year. And I think we love Scout partly because she has really endearing flaws, sort of the Han Solo principle. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes get scared by that because I've mentioned, I think becoming a better comedian often makes me a worse person because I'll notice a moral failing in myself. And instead of trying to fix it, I make a joke out of it. Like, Kellen, when you watch your favorite stand-up comics, how often do you come out of it and say, what a good person?
Yeah, it's unhealthy for a couple of reasons. The first one is this comic is, you know, confessing to this weakness. But then everyone in the audience is like, ha, 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 ha. We do the same thing. And now it's okay because we're laughing. All right. Lesson 3, treat people intelligently. So I think whatever it is that you create, stories, products, services, or even just interpersonally in meetings and conversation, if you treat people as intelligent, they will rise to it. But once you make someone feel unintelligent, they'll become a defensive monster because everyone wants to feel smart, Dave. Like, a movie always loses me when there's a flashback to a scene from 9 minutes earlier. I'm always like, yeah, I can connect things. Like, I don't need the editor to hold my hand. So Harper Lee does this so well throughout the book. And part of it, I think, is by giving us some very intelligent characters, she makes us feel intelligent, enlightened, even just for having read it. For example, so you were talking about Scout, and while the adult Scout is mostly the narrator of the story, we sort of ambiguously go back and forth between child Scout's perspective and older Scout's mind, but all the while she's just this smart, no-nonsense, articulate firecracker of a person. So this character choice does so many things. It gives her credibility. It gives us a clear picture of her upbringing with a well-educated father. You just love spending time with her. She is one of my favorite characters in all of literature. So here are a few of my favorite quotes of hers. At one point, she says, "It was well after midnight, and I was puzzled by his amiable acquiescence." But my favorite one in the book is when she's describing this scene backstage of a play that she's in that's about to begin. She says, quote, "Children dressed as various agricultural enterprises crowded around." And I think it's such a great example of how, like, the compelling part of a story doesn't have to come at the end of a story, right? I see this with young stand-up comics a lot where they tell this long story and the punchline is at the end. But even if a story technically only has a funny part at the end, you can still make up your own funny parts as you're making your way to the end, even if it's just how you say things.
Right.
Scout could have just said something factual like, kids were wearing costumes that looked like potatoes and corn. But that just puts a story in cruise control. Whereas to me, a character who is constantly engaging, it's like taking off the cruise control and just hitting the gas repeatedly. Which will get you 3 stars if you're my Uber driver, but I welcome it figuratively in a book.
Am I weak if I only give 5 stars on Uber?
No. The only time that I've given a 4-star review was when a guy, he had 2 phones up, and one of them had the Uber GPS, and the other phone was on the Waze app. And the Waze app was 7 minutes longer, and that's the one that he took. So it's like you could see it in real time. His Uber app was constantly telling him to turn around. And he was like,
oh, no,
nah, this hipster GPS is better.
Ways to grift you.
I get to pick up candy and stuff.
I do feel like Harper Lee constantly credits the intelligence of the reader. I feel like another great example of that is Michael Lewis, who wrote like Moneyball, The Big Short, The Undoing Project, The Premonition. The thing I really enjoy about his writing style is that he takes these really complex topics and he delivers them so cleanly and so clearly that you understand them immediately as he's delivering them. And in that moment where you understand something complex, you feel smart as well. Mm. So the whole time you're reading, you feel like a genius, even though he's the genius.
Yes. That's how I am with every Christopher Nolan movie.
Yeah.
Because he can be sort of, you know, subtle and cryptic, and he always tries to engage you with big ideas. Mm-hmm. So I always walk out saying loudly to everyone around me, like, that was fun. I understood everything.
Is that how you met your wife?
So one more note on treating people intelligently. Last week I was doing shows in Cleveland, and after one of the shows, these three women came up to me and they said, "We appreciated your humor because it's intelligent and we're scientists."
What do you bet that's the line they use to drop the fact that they're scientists?
And then they sort of explain themselves more. One of them said, "In your joke about Roombas, you use the word rhombus." And I was like, "Oh, yes. Hello, peers." I remembered a word from middle school. So now, like, I have two new bits where I say trapezoid and parallelogram.
While walking into the Large Hadron Collider, they just wave you through.
Bring him in. He's the smart comedian. All right, lesson four. Empathy takes imagination. So to me, Scout's dad, Atticus Finch, is the background protagonist of this book. Sort of like R2-D2 or Thanos. Like, it is interesting, like, Thanos's thought process, because when you watch the movie, you're like, that's horrible that this guy, he wants to essentially kill half of the population. But then when I see the wait time for Space Mountain is 45 minutes, that's when I'm standing there like...
That's when you understand.
Yeah. The Avengers were the villains.
I would love if Malthus, that big overpopulation economist, came to his conclusion in line at a Taco Bell.
I do think that the dark truth is, okay, imagine that you're in line for the Haunted Mansion. The blip happens. There has to be a percentage of those people that were like, oh, this is terrible. But they're also just moving forward in the now much shorter line.
You also know that when the blip happened, there were some people who were in terrible marriages who were secretly relieved. And then 5 years later, were like,
oh, that was Thanos? I thought it was that chicken bone I broke with myself. So one way that I view this story is that it's basically a series of vignettes that illustrate each time the incredible amount of empathy that Atticus has, and that would have been required of a white person who grew up in this region and era in order to properly have defended a black man in court. Because when you get to the end of the book, it becomes the sum of its parts. But when you read it, it does seem to have a chapter here and there where you're not quite sure what its purpose is. So here are a couple of examples of Atticus's empathy. We've learned from the kids, Scout and Jim, that there is this very ornery neighbor that they have to walk by every day after school. And she'll just yell obnoxious things to them to the point where they found that it actually serves them better to walk in front of her house rather than across the street, because in that situation, she's yelling louder to the whole neighborhood and harassing them more publicly. So the closer they are to her front porch, the better.
That's the equivalent of trying to take an online debate to the DMs.
Dave is describing his Saturday nights. So then Scout describes this one experience that they have walking home now with their father as they're passing this grumpy neighbor. Atticus says, "Good evening, Mrs. Du Bois. You look like a picture tonight." And then Scout says, "He never said a picture of what." But then she continues, "It was times like these when I thought my father, who hated guns and had never been to any wars, was the bravest man who ever lived." And I just love this moment because you know from past episodes that I'm such a fan of these sentences that serve more than one purpose. And this to me is just, it's layered with Scout's fear of Mrs. Du Bois, her admiration for her father. But it also shows Atticus's empathy for a woman who is pretty rotten on the outside. But we find out later in the book that she has been dealing with very heavy baggage for years. Mm-hmm. Then one other example of Atticus's empathy. At one point, when he's almost beat up by a small mob, they get stopped because of his kids, Scout and Jim, happening to arrive just at the right place at the right time. And when he's speaking to his kids the next morning, he says, "You children last night made Walter Cunningham stand in my shoes for a minute, and that was enough." So even in this moment, he isn't even directly like berating this mob. He's pulling a larger takeaway from it for his kids and telling them that the most important thing was empathy. So again, to me, one of the reasons why this book is so satisfying and it becomes the sum of its parts is because in the end, Atticus presents just this incredible performance during the trial that it's completely built on empathy and how can he best persuade this jury to be in Tom Robinson's shoes, this black man's shoes.
Yeah, it does seem like some of the biggest atrocities happen when we convince ourselves that someone else or a group of people, that they're less than human. Like you see that with the Holocaust, where Jewish people were called vermin, or in Rwanda, where people were called cockroaches. You see it in the pseudoscience in America that classified black people as subhuman in various ways. All these mechanisms for treating people as though they're not human or they're less than human. And I think that a powerful story can get the listener to flip a switch and all of a sudden see someone as human who they didn't see as fully human before and ask the question, oh, what if that were me?
Yeah, I think a modern example of this that's still an issue is homeless people.
Yeah.
Because I don't know how many times I've heard people, you know, complaining in LA about the encampments that happened under overpasses and on bridges. They're like, you know, my drive to work is just... it's uglier than it used to be. When it's like, these are mentally ill people who are just trying to survive outside. So it's insane to me when people are opposed to like housing projects for these poor people, who many of them, they do just need to be taken care of and they don't have any family. And I think it's very different for anyone who actually knows one of these people who is living on the street with virtually no friends or family. You see it a little differently.
As soon as you have a loved one in that group, it becomes much harder to demonize them.
Mm-hmm. Putting it that way, I think the trick to empathy is, all right, so you don't have a loved one who is mentally ill and homeless. Now, pretend that you do. Like, if we can just flip that switch, maybe we can choose to consider them more human.
It is crazy that we are just so egotistical that we have to be like, but what if it were you to care? Like, there's this book called The War Before the War that talks about the political climate pre the Civil War. And one of the biggest abolitionist arguments to get people to pay attention was, well, what if people start having white slaves? And then people would hear that and be like, oh, no.
Oh, wow.
All right, lesson five. Learn from Harper's road to success. Or as Kellen would call her, Lee.
Yes.
So there are a couple things I loved about her personal story. One is, if you want to get really good at something, it helps to have friends who are also working on that thing. Sort of that idea of you can't get good at tennis by yourself. So Dill in the book is based on her childhood friend, Truman Capote. And I'm still blown away that they were friends. But I also don't think it's a coincidence, because you see lots of stories of good friends who made each other a lot better, like Lennon McCartney, Kahneman Tversky, the Curies. Another lesson I got was, get a day job that lets you get better at your passion. So Harper was a reservation clerk at an airline, so she would have extra time to write. And it reminds me of how Einstein had a crappy job in a patent office when he wrote four papers that changed the world. And Originals has that whole list of people who kept their day job till the passion took off, like Steve Wozniak, Ava DuVernay, John Legend. And that's why so many people keep their day job in Congress till they can make millions as a lobbyist, which I find inspiring. Finally, a last career lesson from Harper Lee. Once you never have to work again, don't. All right, random facts. So we talk about the central metaphor of the book that to kill a mockingbird is a sin because mockingbirds are innocent and they just make music and they do no harm. But we talk less about how in the same paragraph, Atticus tells them it's fine to just destroy a blue jay. And he doesn't even say why. He just makes it clear that they're on his kill list for some reason.
So at one point, Scout starts to understand the harassment that her father is getting for defending a black man. And people are calling him horrible things to Scout. And when Scout finally relays it to her father, because it's been bothering her, he comforts her by saying, it's never an insult to be called what somebody thinks is a bad name. It just shows you how poor that person is. And this is one of my favorite quotes from the book, because now when I read bad stuff about myself online, I'm just like, they don't have money.
So there's a scene where Scout's uncle Jack lies to her, and Atticus says, children are children, but they can spot an evasion quicker than adults. And I'm like, no, sorry, kids are so easy to lie to. They are so easy to trick.
So this is just one of my favorite quotes and like character illustrating moments from her. She says, word got out that Scout Finch wouldn't fight anymore. This wasn't entirely correct. I wouldn't fight publicly for Atticus, but the family was private ground. I'd fight anyone from a third cousin upwards, tooth and nail.
She's so great.
I love it.
A great quote from the book. Things are always better in the morning. It reminds me of this writer, Lydia Netzer, who says, the idea you should never go to bed mad is just stupid. She says, basically, go to bed mad. In the morning, wake up and make pancakes, and the fight isn't going to seem nearly as serious.
So, To Kill a Mockingbird originally was just going to be called Atticus, but Lee decided to change it because she didn't want the focus to, you know, to just be on him. And I think To Kill a Mockingbird is just one of those beautiful titles where it's sort of revealed halfway through, like, you know, Catcher in the Rye or Green Eggs and Ham.
I would love if Green Eggs and Ham was a last second addition to that story. He's like, let's see, can I fit it in the word count? I can. Don't worry, because Atticus in my Alabama expanded universe is going to be the name of Atticus Finch's dark, gritty origin story.
Well, I do think it's interesting when stories or books, when the author decides on either a clever title or just the guy's name. So I have this idea for a game show where it's called Name the Movie Name. So it's a like a movie trivia game with two contestants. Each of them has 3 seconds to name the name of Tom Hanks' character in the movie. And so the first person just gets like, all right, The Money Pit, Cloud Atlas, Splash, and the other guy just gets movies that are Forrest Gump, Larry Crown, Charlie Wilson's War.
Sully.
But I do appreciate that. I mean, when you consider sort of the layered names that most Pixar movies have, other than Cars, but like if Up was just called Carl, Carl and his crazy balloon house. So if I'm not mistaken, she wrote this. And then like 5 years ago, she released the sequel to it.
Well, here was my perception of it. She released this. Ghost at a Watchman was an earlier draft of To Kill a Mockingbird. And for decades and decades, people are like, you can write another book. You can give more interviews. And she was like, I said what I had to say. And then lo and behold, end of her life when she's like 80 something. What? Now she does want to publish it. And she wasn't coerced or pressured. It just feels pretty fishy.
Yeah, I want to know, there's that conspiracy too, speaking of Truman Capote, that he actually wrote this book.
I read up a little bit on that. There doesn't seem to be any basis for that. And in fact, she helped him a lot on In Cold Blood, and he did not credit her. So if anything, she gets too little credit on his work, not the other way around.
Well, you believe in UFOs, so I can have this.
I said we can't rule them out.
I understand and I don't. I understand that it is hard as a fellow and equal artist. It is hard to create something that gets a lot of approval and then it becomes daunting to outdo yourself because some people try and they're never able to do it. M. Night Shyamalan. To me, the motivation is to try and outdo myself. It sounds like a nice quote of, I said what I had to say, but I refuse to believe that anyone only has one song in them.
You're saying this as an argument for Truman Capote wrote it?
No, I'm saying this as an argument for, like, I don't know why she didn't write more. If you have this incredible talent, why not share more of that with the world? Or at the very least, just do it for yourself, you know? Because to me, it's just a very eloquent way of admitting that you're lazy because I just don't know. Like, I release a comedy album and then I don't for 30 years. Like, you can't just say, well, I told all the jokes that the universe wanted me to, and I've been collecting residuals pretty comfortably, so I'm fine.
So to be sure I understand your position, you started by saying that this book is excellent and she wrote one of your all-time favorite characters, and you're also like, boo, is that it?
Yep. So the Truman Capote thing, I actually only believe that about 10%. But the one argument that I do have is that Harper Lee's writing regimen sounds like someone guessing what an author's writing routine would be. Because allegedly she wrote 12 hours a day and she would only churn out a page or less. And doesn't that just seem like it was an answer to an unexpected question in an interview? Like, so you just won the Pulitzer. What's your secret like? What is a day of writing like for the great Harper Lee? And she's like, well, I work for 12 hours just like everyone else. And I write 200 words? It's like looking out of the side of her eye, like, does that sound good? 200's a lot.
But if it's true that a page does take her 12 hours, don't you now buy that she wouldn't want to write another book? All right, to recap, our favorite lessons from To Kill a Mockingbird. 1, goodness is a skill that can be learned. 2, we are often endeared to people for their flaws. 3, treat people intelligently. 4, empathy takes just a little imagination. 5, learn from Harper's Road to Success.
And 6, At some point in the near future, we'll be covering the author's sequel to this book, In Cold Blood.